On the last Sunday, which was the 16th, was so chaotic at the beginning of class, and I completely forgot to record it. So I'm sitting here in the basement. This is Thursday night, and I'm going to go over what I talked about on Sunday, just in case there's somebody who might want to listen to it, although I apologize for being so late about it. Anyway, we were right in the middle of al-Ashari and his treatise titled The Elucidation of Islam's Foundation. And it's 18 chapters long. But the first chapter is just sort of an introduction. Chapters 2 and 3 are actually summaries of what's coming up, and so that's what I've actually been focusing on. And so last week I read from chapter 2, where he is complaining about the doctrines of the Mu'tazilites, and this whole thing is advertised as a refutation of the Mu'tazilites. So in order of the doctrines that he mentions. There are six of them that he's opposed to. And number one has to do with whether sinners can be forgiven by this intercession of the Prophet, the intercession of Muhammad. The Mu'tazilites say no. Interestingly, we kind of have this liberal-conservative dichotomy in our own heads, and we think of the Mu'tazilites as the liberals and the Asharites as the conservatives. But that's not true across the board. And as far as the possibility of, a purgatorial sort of state, the Asharites were more favorable toward that idea than the Mu'tazilites. And the Mu'tazilites did not hold that anybody could be interceded for or forgiven by God if that person was interceded for by the Prophet. It's kind of like, reminds me of, obviously, of the Catholic doctrine, the praying to a saint and having the saint intercede for you. So it's a bit like that. The Mu'tazilites say no, and the Asharites say, yeah, that's possible. So that's number one. Number two has to do with punishment in the grave. This would be physical torture in the grave. The Mu'tazilites say, that's no, that doesn't happen, and this is his second objection to the Mu'tazilite school. The third objection is the objection to the Mu'tazilite claim that the Quran was created. And their thinking, of course, is that, the Quran was revealed to Muhammad via the angel Gabriel at a certain time. And then Muhammad, who was illiterate, went to somebody who was literate and recited what Gabriel said to him, and it was written down. Well, it was obviously created then, right? But from the Asharite perspective, there's an eternal Quran, or else the Quran is a part of the eternal preserved tablet sitting in heaven. And so it's not the case that it was created. It was simply, Tom used the analogy of downloading a PDF. The PDF is already there, and all you have to do is download it. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. So the Mu'tazilites are saying the Quran is kind of like creating an email or a text or something, and at that point it comes into being. And the Asharites are saying, no, it's like a PDF. It was there eternally, and it was simply downloaded at some point. Well, actually downloaded in stages, I guess, because there were multiple revelations, right? And number four, this is the big one, I think, and certainly from our point of view, it's the big one. And that is that God, the Mu'tazilites, claim that human beings have free will. They are free to either sin or act righteously. It's completely up to us. God does not control us. God has kind of drawn back and given us free will and given us the ability to chart our own course, and therefore we're responsible for what we do. Not so, say the Asherites. Number five, and this is another one kind of like the intercession issue, the damnation is eternal. Well, maybe not, say the Asherites. And then another big one, and actually we didn't get to this one last Sunday, so we'll talk about it next week. But this is the question of whether the Quran should be read literally or metaphorically. Are the attributes of God metaphorical or not? I mean, you know, the Quran talks about God's arms and God's hands and God's eyes and God's throne and all sorts of things like that. Well, is that just, anthropomorphic imagery to make it more vivid? So say the Mu'tazilites. Or, because the Quran says it, it must be literally true. So says Al-Ash'ari, founder of the Asharite school. So those are the six issues. I'll recap them real quickly. That, number one, that sinners are not forgiven by the intercession of the Prophet. Number two, that there is no punishment in the grave. Number three, that the Quran is created. Number four, that God does not control what you and I do, that we're free. Number five, that damnation is eternal. And number six, that God's attributes are just metaphorical. So, in response to that, I read the relevant sections of chapter 3, which is the summary of what he says in much more detail in the ensuing chapters. So, he doesn't cover them in the same order in chapter 3, but I'll cover them in the same order. So, I'll jump around a little bit. And actually, as I intimated, 5 and 1 are really linked. Remember, 5 was damnation is eternal, and 1 had to do with the intercession issue. So let me read you the paragraph here, which actually covers both 5 and 1, since they are kind of connected. It is our opinion that we ought not to declare a single one of the people of the Qibla an infidel for a sin of which he is guilty, such as fornication or theft or the drinking of wine, as the Harajites held, thinking that such people are infidels. But we believe that he who commits any of these mortal sins, such as fornication or theft or the like, presumptuously declaring it lawful and not acknowledging that it is forbidden, is an infidel. We believe that Islam is more extensive than faith, and faith is not the whole of Islam. In other words, these people may have faith, but they're not acting properly. We hold that God changes men's hearts, and that their hearts are between two of God's fingers, and that God will place the heavens on a finger and the earth on a finger. And the footnote, says on the last day. The changing of men's hearts, the footnote thinks, is at death, referring to at death, although that didn't work with Pharaoh. But anyway, God will place the heavens on a finger and the earth on a finger, as we are told in the tradition that comes down on the authority of God's apostle. We hold that we ought not to relegate any of the monotheists, or those who hold fast to the faith, to paradise or to hell, save him whose favor the apostle of God has borne witness concerning paradise. And we hope that sinners will attain to paradise, but we fear that they will be punished in hell. We believe that God, by the intercession of Muhammad, God's apostle, will bring forth a people from hell after they have been burned to ashes, in accordance with what we are told in the traditions related on the authority of God's apostle. So, Al-Ash'ari is holding out the hope that through the intercession of the Prophet, once they've been burned to ashes, once they've suffered enough, I guess, that people will be brought forth from hell. So that sounds a bit like purgatory, doesn't it? So anyway, that's, but I mean, the, but the Metazoites hold that, you know, one's fate in the afterlife is fixed and that there is no intercession that can come to alter that situation. So that's the first, well, actually that's one in five. So now let's go in order. Number two was punishment in the grave. So where's that one? Oh, it's right following what I just read. We believe in the punishment in the grave. And here's a bunch of references, by the way, to either verses in the Quran or traditions having to do with the afterlife. And in the pool, and hold that the scales are real, and the bridge is real, and the resurrection after death is real, and that God will line up human beings at the station and settle the account with the faithful. Let's see. The pool is a reference in the traditions. The scales in the Quran, that would be the just balance, the you know, the weighing of the, we've talked about this, the weighing of the soul after death, which has the greater weight, the good deeds or the bad deeds. Remember we talked about stacking them up and all that sort of stuff? So that's from the Quran. The bridge, I know a little bit about that. That's an idea of an extremely narrow bridge that everybody has to walk over, but it's part of the traditions. The resurrection after death, okay, and that God will bring up human beings at the station. And 112, what does that say? It just says, see the Encyclopedia of Islam. That must be another tradition, though. And settle the account with the faithful. Okay. We believe that faith consists of words and deeds and is subject to increase and decrease. Before he had said there's more to it than just faith. Here he makes faith more expansive. And we receive the authentic traditions regarding it, related on the authority of the apostle of God, which the trustworthy have transmitted one just man from another, until the tradition goes back to the apostle of God. Okay. So, on the punishment in the grave and all the other details from the Quran and from the traditions having to do with, you know, one's fate after death and so forth, the al-Ashari is taking all this very literally. There is such a thing as punishment in the grave. Then, number three, having to do with the creation of the Quran, here's what he says. We believe, too, that the Quran is the uncreated word of God, and that he who believes the Quran is created is an infidel. Okay? So that's number three. Now, number four. This is the really big one, and I spent a long time talking about this one. After all, we didn't get, I mean, we have only, after this one, the only one that's left is number six, so, and I didn't get to that one. So I must have spent an awful long time talking about this one. And I gave quite a bit of background to it. This is the idea that, well, I'll read it again. The complaint is that the Metazoites hold that God does not control what is subject to human free will. But it's a lot deeper than that. I started off talking about Parmenides, who lived around 500 BCE. And Parmenides held that everything is one and unchanging, at least from the most rigorous point of view. If you think that reality is multiple and mutable, that's really a distorted view of reality. The more accurate way of seeing reality is that what truly is can only be one thing, and it doesn't change. That's because the verb sounds like that, right? It sounds like a single thing, what is, and is not a matter of change. So it's partly a analysis of the concept. Well, anyway, Zeno, who was Parmenides' pupil, tried to defend Parmenides' Parmenideism, Parmenides' theory, Eleaticism, I guess you could say, this is the Eleatic school, by formulating a bunch of paradoxes. And of course, the Zeno's paradoxes are fairly famous. One of them, for example, probably the most famous one, is the dichotomy. And that's the idea that, well, to get from point A to point B, you have to go halfway, right? But to get halfway, you have to go half of that. And to get halfway of that, you have to go half of that, and half of that, and half of that, and half of that. The point is, you can never even get started because you keep on going forever. You keep on taking half, and it keeps on going forever. Well, you know, those are tantalizing conceptual puzzles. And, you know, even nowadays, philosophers, you know, think about them and treat them. There are various ways in which different philosophers have attempted to meet the paradoxes and remove their paradoxical character, because the whole point that Zeno was trying to make was, if you accept change and multiplicity, you wind up with these, you just wind up with these incoherent conclusions. They result in incoherence, such as the one we just talked about. And, one way of dealing it, not the only way, but one way of dealing with the paradox is to deny that space is infinitely divisible. Why is that important? Well, because the paradox obviously depends on an assumption, right? In other words, you cut in half, from A to B, you cut that in half, and then you cut that in half, and you cut that in half, and so forth and so on. You keep on going forever. Well, the assumption there is that, you know, you can do that forever, and that means that space is infinitely divisible. So one way to get out of the paradox is simply to deny the infinite divisibility of space. At some point, you reach the minimum interval of space. And so you're off and running at that point. Then you can start moving. And that's what Epicurus did. We know this because of Lucretius. We're in decent shape regarding Epicureanism, mainly because we have Lucretius's poem. So Epicurus adopted the atomic theory. And Leucippus and Democritus had held that if you take something apart, there are minimal material components of any given thing that can't be divided further, and these are called atoms, and atom simply means uncuttable. But even smaller than atoms are the minimal blocks of space. Space has, because, you know, atoms have shapes, right? They have to have shapes because they hook onto one another. They're like Velcro, you know, they hook onto one another, so they have shapes. Well, you can describe their shapes. Well, you describe the shape in terms of the space that the atom takes up. But for the reason I mentioned a minute ago with respect to Zeno's paradoxes, Epicurus held that you can't divide space up forever, that space also has minimal parts, and a typical atom will occupy many, many minimal parts of space. I don't think you'd ever have an atom that was a minimum of space and volume. No, I don't think you would. Well, anyway, though. So then thinking this through some more. If you accept the idea that space is discrete and not continuous, in other words, that there is a minimum division there in space, if you accept that, it follows that time also has to be discrete. Why is that? Well, think about it. If you ask the question, how long does it take to go across a minimum of space? Okay, if you say, you know, t, it takes t. And then you say, well, how about half of t, t over 2? Where is it at that point? Well, it can't be halfway across a minimum of space, because otherwise then it wouldn't be a minimum anymore, right? So time must move in jumps sort of corresponding to the way that space is divided up into these small discrete units. And as a matter of fact, the time it takes to traverse a minimum of space would be a minimum of time. So for the Epicureans, space and time are discrete and not continuous. They both have minimal parts. Okay. Now, it turns out that one of the Indian philosophical schools, it was the Vaisheshika school, also developed an atomic theory. And that school also held that there were sort of atomic units of space and time as well. So we have, I don't think there's any connection between them. It's just a case of similar ideas popping up in different places. Now, we're not sure if the Asherites got the idea from the Greeks or from the Indians or from both. They could have gotten them from both. I mean, they would certainly know about the atomic theory from Aristotle, because Aristotle talks a lot about that. In a lot of Aristotle's works, he reviews the ideas of his predecessors on whatever topic it is he's going to talk about. And among them were Leucippus and Democritus. So they would have been familiar with at least the atomic theory from Aristotle. So I've not read, and I don't know if we even know, exactly where al-Ashari and his successors got the idea. Actually, well, I do know this, that even before al-Ashari, al-Razi, who was a philosopher, not a theologian, adopted the atomic theory and also adopted the anti-religious strain from the that we find in the Epicureans. So consequently, his writings do not survive. They were destroyed, most of them. And so he was an atomist, and so it was in the air, certainly in the Islamic world, in the philosophical schools. So I mean, he could have become aware of them, you know, that from that source. But as I say, somebody got the idea from either the Greeks or the Indians or both. Well, anyway, why is this important? Well, al-Ashari takes the atomic theory and uses it to defend God's absolute sovereignty and God's all-powerful nature. I have said many times, you know, that we have these traditional orthodox attributes that we apply to God, and yet any given theologian is going to emphasize one above all the others, and then is going to have to scramble to explain away how we can talk about these other attributes while at the same time seeing God in the main along the lines of whatever the favorite attribute is. I mean, Origen, for example, I use him a lot. You know, God's benevolent. And then, well, how could God be just if God is so benevolent? And, you know, so forth and so on. So, well, anyway, in the Asherite scheme of things, though, it's God's power. God's all-powerful. God's omnipotent. And anything less than an absolute control over the universe would demean God's omnipotence. And the way in which al-Ashari chose to characterize God's absolute control of everything was in terms of the atomic theory, and especially the discrete nature of space and time. This is the way it goes in the Asherite school. Remember, because time now is composed of minimal instants, let's call them instants. At every instant, and instants are really, really tiny, but at every instant, God is recreating the state at every minimal part of space in the universe. That's a lot of minimal parts, right, in the universe. You know, because minimal parts, minima of space, are so unbelievably tiny. Atoms are unbelievably tiny, and minima of space are even tinier. You know, at every instant, God is recreating the state of every minimum of space in the universe. And you might think, well, that makes God pretty busy, and that's certainly true, but, you know, God's omnipotent, so God can do anything, right? God can do that. God can pull that off. That's no problem. If an object is not changing, then in that minimum of space, the next time around, at the next instant, whatever was at that in that location is exactly the way it was the last time around. But if there's a change, either a change of attributes or motion, then the next time around, it's going to be a little different. For example, suppose a body is moving. Well, okay, at T1, imagine the back of the body, the tail of the body, is in minimum X, and then let's call it minimum Y, and minimum X is one minimum over toward the head of the body, okay? And the body is going to be moving in the direction of the head. So at time T1, both X and Y are occupied, right? They're full. You know, a minimum of space is in two states. It's either occupied or not. You know, it's either occupied by a body or it's a void. It's empty. So time T1, X and Y are both occupied. Okay. At time T2, because the object is moving in the direction of Y, X becomes void, but Y is still occupied. But on the other end, right, A and B, say it was at B, but at time T1, the head was at B and A was unoccupied. At time T2, both A and B are occupied by a body. You see what I mean then? And of course, that means things are moving in jumps all the time. But since, first of all, instants are so incredibly quick, and since minima of space are so incredibly tiny, I mean, there's no way we can detect that any more than we can detect in a movie. You know, we're throwing up all these images, but it looks like smooth motion to us. You know, and when you look at a computer screen, the pixels, you know, they're nowhere near as small as minimal parts. But those we can't really distinguish very well. Things really do look round. They look like they're moving, although we know that they're really jumping, you know. So anyway, that means then that God, well, it's a very strong determinism, right? There's only one actor in the universe, and that's God. At every instant of time, the entire universe is getting recreated by God. That means that God is in control of everything. And then as far as human affairs go, I mean, I haven't even been talking about humans. Yeah, I've been talking at sort of the microscopic level, but all you need to do is, you know, draw the conclusion for human life. Everything that happens, puppets, as it were. And as a matter of fact, speaking of puppets, this whole theory is called occasionalism, because events that happen, or I should say causal events, when A causes B, are really not causes at all. I mean, the example I used was a Punch and Judy show, right? Two puppets. And say Judy is hitting Punch over the head with a broom, and Punch rubs his head, okay? Then we would say, well, Punch's rubbing his head was caused by Judy hitting him over the head with a broom. We say that, but we know that's not what's really happening, right? There's only one cause, and that's the puppeteer. It just looks like Judy's hitting him over the head with a broom is causing him rubbing his head, right? But that's really not the case. It's only the occasion of Punch's rubbing his head, see? So you apply that, say, to motion of two billiard balls. Billiard ball A is moving along. It hits billiard ball B, and say they're the same mass. So A stops, and B has 100% of the momentum of A, and it starts moving along. And we say that the motion of A was the cause of the motion of B. Not true, says Al-Ashari. There's only one cause, and that's God. The motion of A was only the occasion of the motion of B, just as Judy's hitting Punch over the head is only the occasion of Punch's rubbing it, because there's only one cause, it's the puppeteer, and in the universe there's only one cause, and that's God, you see. So that means then that, you know, we don't have free will, right? If we do things that are right, well, that's because God wants it that way. If we screw up, that means that God wants it that way. You know, you don't like it? Tough. You don't get to complain about God. Why, who do you think you are, puny little human? So, let's read what Al-Ashari has to say. He's not talking about the atomic theory here. He's talking about it on the very macroscopic level. But he is talking about, you know, human beings and our lack of free will. This is what he has to say. Let's see. We believe that the Word of God was uncreated, and that he has created nothing without first saying to it, be, and it is. As he has said, our word is a thing, this is from the Quran, our word to a thing when we will it is but to say, be, and it is. And that there is no good or evil on earth save what God wishes, and that things exist by God's wish, and that not a single person has the capacity to do anything until God causes him to act, and we are not independent of God, nor can we pass beyond the range of God's knowledge, and that there is no creator save God, and that the works of human beings are things created and decreed by God, as he has said, and this is another quote, God has created you and what you make, end of quote. And that human beings have not the power to create anything, but are themselves created, as he has said, quote, is there a creator other than God? And as he has said, they create nothing, but are themselves created. And as he has said, shall he then who creates be as he who creates not? And as he has said, were they created by nothing, or were they created, or were they creators? For this is mentioned in God's book frequently. And that God gives the faithful grace to be obedient to him, is gracious to them, considers them, does what is salutary for them, guides them, whereas he causes the infidels to err, does not guide them, does not give them the grace to believe, as the deviators and rebels think, for if he were gracious to them and did what was salutary for them, they would be sound, and if he guided them, they would be guided, as he has said, quote, he whom God guides is the guided, and they whom he misleads shall be the lost. And that God has the power to do what is salutary for the infidels and gracious to them, that they may become believers. Nevertheless, he wills that they will that they be infidels, and he knows. And that he forsakes them and seals up their hearts. And that good and evil are dependent upon the general and particular decrees of God. That's a long sentence. It's over, though. We believe in God's general and particular decrees, his good and his evil, his sweet and his bitter, and we know that what passes us by was not to befall us, and what befalls us was not to pass us by. And the human beings do not control for themselves what is hurtful or what is helpful, except what God wishes, and that we ought to commit our affairs to God and assert our complete need of and dependence upon him. Okay. Also noteworthy here, another corollary, I guess, of God's total control of everything, is you'll note We believe in God's general and particular decrees. Just before that. And that good and evil are dependent upon the general and particular decrees of God. We believe in God's general and particular decrees, as good and as evil, as sweet and as bitter, and so forth. Good and evil are dependent upon the decrees of God. In the Euthyphro, Plato had Socrates ask the question, does God will what is good because it's good? Or is what's good good because God wills it? Right? It's really asking, you know, which is more fundamental, the good or God's will? Does God will what is good because it's good? Well, if that's the case, then the good is more fundamental. Or is the good good because God wills it? And if that's the case, then God's will is more fundamental. Well, you know good and well which side Al-Ashari is going to fall on. He's going to fall on the second side. What is good because God wills it. And another one of the, not in this work, but another one that I've read, he makes, I think, the shocking statement. He says, if God had willed lying to be good, lying would be good. It's completely dependent on the will of God. And lying is not bad because of its intrinsic nature at all. It's bad because God decided, man, I don't like it, so let's not do it. That's just a corollary, really, of God's absolute control over everything. I mean, there's nothing left that God doesn't control. So, the picture here, and like I say, this number four here is a very major issue. The big picture is that, you know, nothing is going to compromise God's absolute sovereignty over the universe. That God at every instant is recreating the entire universe, and that therefore there is nothing that you and I do that is really due to our own free wills. That if one thing appears to cause something else in the universe, it doesn't really cause it, it's only the occasion of it. And even good and evil are simply arbitrary decrees of God. God has decided for no particular reason. And besides, it's certainly not your business to question what God decides. You know, when God has decided some things are good, some things are evil. But not because they're good or evil, absolutely, but because God has simply decided that's what God wants. So that's a big, big, big issue. The Metazoites had argued for human free will. They, like Origen, had said, you know, what sense does it make to command us to do something if we don't have the free will to do it or not do it? But for Al-Ashari, that's perfectly okay, because if we had free will, then that means that God, there's something that God doesn't control, and that is inconsistent with God's absolute omnipotence. See? So that's as far as I got. And this is Thursday, so in what, 1, 2, 3 days, I'm going to be doing number 6, the question about how one needs to interpret the Quran. And when I'm done with that, then we'll move over to Al-Ghazali, probably the greatest of the Islamic theologians in the Middle Ages, maybe the greatest of all time. And we'll look at the, one thing I'm going to look at is the Jerusalem letter, which is kind of a short summary of his ideas, and very much in the line of Asharite theology, because Al-Ghazali was an Asharite. So we'll do that next week, or this Sunday, rather. So that's it. Bye.